The trade deficit grows again.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. The trade deficit grew in March to $40.4 billion, the highest it's been since 2008. Here to help us figure out what this means is Paul Ashworth, senior economist at Capital Economics. He joins us live. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Stacey.
Paul, both imports and exports rose by more than 3% in March. So what is this telling us about the U.S. economy?
Well, as far as the U.S. economy is concerned, is telling us that both consumers and businesses are beginning to spend more freely, and of course some of the dollars they're spending are going on goods that are made abroad.
If people are spending more freely, is that a sign of increasing consumer confidence?
I think it is, yes. Obviously we've been through a very steep recession. We're slowly now beginning to come out the other side.
I know that the trade deficit tends to widen when the economy is growing, is that right?
It does, yes. Obviously, you know, the U.S. economic growth is beginning to pick up, and that obviously some of that is being spent on imports, and that is driving up the deficit. The other thing, of course, is that the price of crude oil on world markets has begun to rise again, and the U.S. is a net importer of oil, so that adds to the deficit as well.
What are some of the drawbacks to a growing deficit?
Well, a trade deficit means that basically, the America spends more on importing goods and services than it earns on exporting them to the rest of the world. Now, like any deficit, that has to be financed, and it's financed through foreigners basically buying U.S. assets. So, in particular, that's often characterized as the Chinese buying U.S. Treasury debt. Now, that's not a problem in the short term, but it could be a problem in the long term, particularly if the Chinese decided to sell some of those bonds, because, of course, then that would drive up borrowing costs, not just for the U.S. government, but also for households and businesses as well.
Paul Ashworth, senior economist at Capital Economics. Paul, thank you.
You're welcome.
The price of oil is down around $76 a barrel this morning. That on worries the debt crisis in Europe could worsen and slow global demand. Markets, though, are up. London's FTSE is up 0.25%. Germany's DAX is up 1.75%. The Shanghai Composite Index added 0.33%. U.S. markets lost a little ground yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by 0.33% to close at 10,748. Morgan Stanley seems to be next in line to the regulatory woodshed. The Wall Street Journal reports federal prosecutors are looking into whether Morgan Stanley bet against its investors and misled clients about derivatives deals. If that sounds familiar, it's almost exactly what lawmakers have been accusing Goldman Sachs of doing. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation wants to require the country's 40 largest banks to create a kind of living will in case they run into financial problems. John Dimsdale has more from Washington.
The FDIC wants major banks to be prepared for their own death. The top 40 banks would have to submit a detailed plan for their own dismantling in the event of financial collapse. That would include a way to separate consumers' money, insured by the government, from the complex financial institutions that own many federally insured banks. FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair supports the proposal, saying early planning will help avoid the need for bailouts. But Scott Talbot with the Bank Trade Association Financial Services Roundtable worries that the living wills sitting at the FDIC would quickly become outdated.
The markets change quickly, as do banks, and so the shelf life of any living will would be short-lived.
He says all the responsibility shouldn't be on banks. Regulators should work with them continuously to plan for problems. The living will proposal is open for a 60-day comment period. After that, the FDIC has the authority to make it a requirement without the need for congressional legislation. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Citrix, offering GoToMeeting, allowing people to hold meetings online to collaborate in real time. More at gotomeeting.com/market. By LendingTree, offering the ability to manage money, credit, and loans all in one place. LendingTree.com. And by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business.
A trial going on in Minnesota right now is testing whether one of the country's biggest banks owes its clients money for getting them into some risky investments. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
Big bank knows its investments are risky, but doesn't come clean. So far, it's playing out like a Midwestern Goldman Sachs, complete with embarrassing emails. Mike Cerisi is the attorney for three foundations and a state workers' comp fund suing Wells Fargo. He showed the jury internal Wells Fargo documents debating whether to tell clients about their sour investments. One refers to investors as hostages.
Their CEO and chairman testified that the investments that they made into certain areas were ones that took enormous risk. They've also described them as being goofy investments.
Cerisi says the foundation signed on for investments that were low risk and easy to cash out. Instead, they got subprime mortgages, commercial paper, and Lehman Brothers. Wells Fargo says these foundations are sophisticated institutional investors. They saw the fine print, signed on the dotted line, and knew there was risk. Terry Fruth is a securities lawyer in Minneapolis. He says the foundations weren't the only ones feeling clueless.
The delicious irony is that the biggest institution in this game, Wells Fargo, didn't understand what they were doing.
In fact, Wells Fargo says most of the money lost in this particular investment pool was its own. Fruth says the jury in St. Paul has to answer one of the toughest questions from the financial crisis, when everyone involved is out of their depth.
Who should be responsible under the law in knowing what they're doing?
If the answer is the bank, Fruth is ready for the lawsuit floodgates to open. He represents another nonprofit lining up to sue Wells Fargo. In St. Paul, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
And finally, WWVC. What would voters cut? That's what House Republicans want to know. Minority Whip Eric Cantor is unveiling U-Cut today. Under the plan, House Republicans will propose five spending cuts for the federal budget every week, and the public will vote for the cut of their choice online or via cell phone. The GOP will argue for the cut that gets the most votes on the floor of the House. Though I'm thinking congressional salaries probably won't be making that list. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.